Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
The city's most dangerous criminals.
You think you scare me?
Have been invited to play the world's most dangerous game.
To win, you eliminate the competition.
Prize is $10 million.
Now everyone is a moving target.
Get down, Lucy.
And the only way to survive...
You having a good time, little girl?
...is to play the game.
Okay, I got one.
Play the game and finish it.
We have to kill them all!
Christopher Lambert, Ice-T.
Are there any other questions?
What if we don't want to play?
Me, Guns.
Any other questions?
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Rob St. Mary is currently running guns to rebel factions in South America. Joining me instead this week is Fred Fritz of the Erase Rewind podcast and the Movie Apocalypse Show. This week we're talking about Mean Guns, the 1997 film from Albert Pyun, written by Andrew Witham. Mean Guns is a story of a group of criminals and a few civilians who spend the night in a massive prison complex making amends to the criminal organization, led by Ice-T, that they once wronged. It's killer versus killer in an intense game of kill 'em all and may the best three win their lives and $10 million. Now, before we dive in, Fred, you may not know it, but you've been getting a lot of play on the Projection Booth lately. Oh. A few weeks ago, Josh Hadley gave you a shout out for helping him track down Paige Connor for the Visitor episode. And 2 weeks ago, I was chatting up Eric Red's Road Trilogy on the Hitcher episode. In essence, your reputation precedes you, sir.
I love Eric Red's work, so yeah, that's good stuff, The Hitcher.
Tell me your impression of Mean Guns and why this one resonates so much for you.
I first discovered Mean Guns by accident in the video store because of the movie Gunman with Christopher Lambert. When I saw the box and I saw that Christopher was in it, I was generally drawn right to Christopher movies. I kind of looked for his stuff. You know, he's one of those faces you recognize and you grab. And I thought, wow, Gunman and now a movie, Mean Guns. You know, is this a play on that or something? I didn't know if they were doing kind of an unofficial sequel. And when I picked it up and realized it was directed by Albert Pyun, I had to have it. I had to see it. And it was definitely not what I expected. Not at all. I was expecting something, I don't want to say grittier. The movie's definitely gritty. But I was definitely expecting something colder. And it is just one of the most fun action movies I have. Seriously, I don't know how to word it, but it was just a blast to watch. There's an energy to this film that just doesn't exist in certain action films today.
No, I totally agree. This one I kind of lucked into a little backwards. Of all people, my wife saw this movie and she recommended it to me. She knows that I'm a big fan of people hunting people movies, you know, like Punishment Park and Battle Royale and all this. And she said, yeah, this one should be on your radar too. And we watched it, and as soon as I saw the cast come up and then when Albert Pyun's name came up, I was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. It bops along, man. It just, I guess it's that Mambo beat just kind of grabs it and propels it through the entire film. It is just a lot of fun and very, very energetic.
Yeah, if you really break this one, at least for me, if you break it down, this film succeeds on every level, and that's rare for B movies, you know, where they hit every point. I was trying to think in order, what are the things that really pop the most, you know, when you kind of watch it? And people can mix and match their orders to whatever they want. But I would say first and foremost is that the dialogue in this is extremely rich. And that's rare for this type of film completely. You don't generally find something this clever in action films. The next element would be, of course, I think as a natural extension to the writing, is the performances. The actors in it are amazing. It's perfectly cast. And then third is definitely a mixture of, and I'm not leaving Albert Pyun. Albert Pyun's the overseer of all this, by the way, so I'm not like negating the direction in this, just for a side note. But the third would be that Mambo score, man. Again, there's just nothing out there like it. This was different on every level. It was the writing, it was the acting, it was the feel of the movie with the music. And of course, Albert Pune's style, just sort of bringing all of this flavor, you know, into the stew. It's really an unusual film all the way around.
I mean, so yeah, it's 97. So by now we've had kind of, I don't know, 4.5, 5 years of, you know, Tarantino knockoff, Tarantino wannabe kind of movies. You know, we've had the clever dialogue, we've had the retro soundtracks, all this kind of malarkey. And this one, you could lump it in there if you wanted to, but I think you'd really be stretching it, because this one kind of stands apart from the rest of these, you know, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead kind of, you know, to me, not very good films. This one for me is head and shoulders above the rest of it. And I think a lot of that comes down to Pune's style and just kind of having the chops to really know how to play this stuff up the right way.
I would actually agree in the sense of Tarantino. I mean, and Tarantino was obviously before this. In fact, even on the commentary that Pune provided, he actually mentions that Andrew's script, he believes, was actually trying to emulate Tarantino just a little bit. Because the original title was, it's like American Vernacular or Vernacular. I can't remember, and I'm drawing a blank all of a sudden. But the script was a very loaded down with a lot of witticisms about pop culture, and it's still in the film too. There are moments. There's a speech by Lou, played by Christopher Lambert, about television today and violence, and the whole film really is a commentary on violence in film. But I believe that's really brought more to the forefront by Pune than it is by the script, because he himself said he doesn't even really like those type of movies, which is little humorous considering what he directs. But it's really it's got that theme of redemption in it. And that's where Quentin's sort of self-stylized, self-reverential leaves the building on this one. You know, this one is about the characters. The characters live and breathe in this story. The actors really brought it to the plate. They're not just, you know, oh, isn't this clever? They're acting in this film. I mean, they're bringing a very solid performance. And I just, this is some of Pune's best work.
I mean, there are a few winks at the camera here and there, but it's not mugging.
It's not self-reverential. It's not. It could have gone that way. It could have totally gone. But it's that last, that last quarter is heartbreaking, man. That's something Quentin's films have never been able to do. Okay. The closest would be Jackie Brown, I think. But he's never brought that. I've never been emotionally involved with his characters. But I am with these characters.
Yeah, he doesn't really let you ever get past that veneer, you know, and those people that are kind of acting too cool for school. If Tarantino had made this, he would have just concentrated on those two killers who are basically comic relief in this film and who I love. And I'm so glad they're there. They are terrific. But I think it would have been all them. They would have been the Jules and Vincent of this film versus the Christopher Lambert character who you know, kind of emotionally invested in. And what I love too is that there are multiple characters that you're actually caring for throughout this whole film, because there's Lambert and, you know, Ice-T is fantastic in his role, and just, yeah, so many of the actors. And of course, we're supposed to be following Van Valkenburgh through this whole thing. You know, she, in essence, should be our protagonist. So we're kind of just all over the place as far as where our allegiances lie. And I think that's another clever thing is the way that he kind of balances the story out throughout this.
It's interesting that a lot of people emulate Tarantino. And one of my problems with his writing and anybody else's writing, that this film is the antithesis, is that all the characters in a Tarantino movie all sound alike. Okay, they all talk pop culture. They all, you know, have little clever references. They all have witticisms. And in this film, each character talks like that character would. And therein lies, the biggest difference. There's our clever speeches, but those speeches are delivered by the characters who would deliver that type of speech. Sometimes it's a surprise, but that gives you a little insight into the character. What you were saying about Deborah being the intended lead, you'd think she'd be the lead. But the focus of the film is redemption, which she's not an individual seeking redemption in this story. I think it's Marcus, the character played by Michael Halsey, who, I'll tell you the truth, as much as I love everybody else in this, it's Michael Halsey's performance that I'm drawn to the most. he really does, his scenes with Christopher are the best in the film.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And that's kind of, again, kind of that nice thing where it's like, you know, Halsey is there, you know, duking it out just as much as some of these other characters. And it's just, you know, it's rare that you can go into a film and have so many people that you actually care about as you're watching it and be able to switch from one to another and, you know, oh yeah, let's see what this guy's story is. And then let's go over here and see what this person's story is. And it's not one of these kind of, you know, like shortcuts or something where you're just really kind of moving from one point to another, from one short story to another kind of thing. It's all integrated and in such a way that everybody is balanced out.
Yeah, I agree. And they all feel like they belong there too.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no like, oh God, this movie would be so much better if that one character wasn't in it.
Right. I mean, the Tina Cotes character of Barbie could have easily been a disposable character, but they even, and that it might have a lot to do with Pune's love of the actress. You know, he's worked with her, all these people he's worked with multiple times. He has that kind of, that reserve of actors he calls upon over and over and over. And she's one of them. And her character could have just been like her name, Barbie. They even make a joke about that in the film that they think she's just stupid. And she's playing them all along.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, it never gets better than Christopher Lambert. I love that guy. I always love him. And I always love his little weird laugh that he does. Yeah, exactly. And just, he does that so often in this film. And every time he does, it just always makes me smile.
Well, the best scene for me involves Michael Halsey's Three Bears, the Three Cannibalistic Bears speech. And I won't ruin it, but there's a follow-up where Lambert basically insults the character of Dee by calling her stupid. And his delivery, it's no one else could have delivered the line the way he did. When you finish watching this, you think no one else could play Lou. That's something that I think is interesting, is a lot of times you think, oh, a good actor could have still done this. You know, any number of, say, three or four good actors could have played this part or that part. Truthfully, Lambert's performance as Lou really is the standout. There's no doubt about it. Marcus, to me, is the main character, and I love Marcus. But it's Lambert's performance that's the standout. There's just no disputing that.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Dame Judi Dench, Her Royal Highness, the Honorary Queen of the British Isles, parts of the Caribbean, and I have a scarf consortium in the basement of Harrods. I'm just here to tell you all about this wonderful, relatively new podcast from the After Movie Diner. There's movie discussion, interviews with independent film directors, music, and abject silliness. First thing every Monday, just in time for your sweaty and stressful commute. Or like me, maybe you're sprawled seductively on a chaise longue waiting for a really good breakfast.
Go to amdpodcast.blogspot.com or search for After Movie Diner on iTunes, TalkShoe, Podbean, or Facebook, and get that dose of goodness that you've been looking for all your sleepless nights, long commutes, lonely weekends, maybe spent dressed in a tutu playing checkers with a machine eating Nutella straight from the jar. It's the After Movie Diner podcast, filled with all the B-movie vitamins your body deserves.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
GGTMC live for you, fresh air.
Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Bringing class to the trash since 1977.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. This week we're going to do something a little bit different with the interview segment. In the past, both Fred and I have talked to director Albert Pune, so you're not getting just one interview with Albert Pune, but two. So now prepare yourself for my hard-hitting grilling of Albert Pune about Mean Guns. I love the mix of the comedy and action that you do in that. And then I also saw a little bit of that in Mean Guns as well. That's also a favorite of mine.
Yeah, Mean Guns was a script that came to me from the company itself, and they wanted to make it. And then when I read it, I really liked it a lot. And I liked the tone of it and the humor that was within the characters. But because it was such an offbeat script, I really wanted to find an offbeat way to tell it. And that's where how the mambo sort of came up in it. And I think the mambo really gives it a sort of a framework to view all these characters and the events.
And yeah, that's it. Just one question. Now, there's a lot more of the interview, and I'll go ahead and I'll post that up for folks to enjoy, but the majority of the interview was about Captain America, which was played in an earlier episode. Hopefully folks have heard that. And it was also about Road to Hell, which is Albert Pune's sequel to Streets of Fire. Originally, that was supposed to run during the Streets of Fire episode, but it didn't. So again, I'll be posting the full interview with Mr. Pune. Now, fortunately, this week's co-host, Fred Fritz, has spoken to Mr. Pune before and is allowing me to replay some of the Q&A about Mean Guns, so let's go ahead and roll that.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, if that's okay,
sure,
to one of my personal favorites, and that's Mean Guns. How did this one come about?
I was looking around for a project that could be shot in one location. I was going to make a film for Imperial Entertainment and Ash, and I knew that Ash was really, you know, he just loved that Hong Kong stuff and the Gonzo style, and mm-hmm. very, very supportive creatively to all the people that made films for him. I asked him, you know, because I knew that he had a reputation around town of looking for really interesting things. I asked him if he had seen anything recently, script-wise, that he thought was really good. And he said, yeah, this is a script. And he gave me the script for Mean Guns, but it was actually called American Vernacular then. It took place all, you know, not in one location, but in one area. So I saw that it could be set just in one location. And I also saw the quality of, it's not really tongue-in-cheek, but it's some wit to it, wit to the action and to the violence. And I liked the style of the language of that film that mm-hmm. the writer created it. So, you know, I said, yeah, I want to do this. And then we set about figuring out how to make it and who would be in it. And, you know, luckily we found a company that's willing to fund it called, at that time, New Market Capital Group. And New Market eventually went on to do, like, Memento and Monster and Well Rider and okay. Passion of the Christ. But at that time, they were much more of like a bank, a boutique bank and finance company. And they said they'll do it. And, you know, I wanted Christopher in the film because I had just finished doing Adrenaline with Christopher, which ended up being a horrific experience for the film because Bob Weinstein took that away and fully redid it. And so I just felt like, you know, I liked the script enough and project enough where I thought that it would be a way of sort of making up for Adrenaline to Christopher. And so he got it right away, saw it, and he jumped on board. And I think I was actually trying to piggyback this film, Mean Guns, with another film that was a take on Treasure Island.
Okay.
And but set in outer space. And so it actually was originally a much more complicated deal because I was trying to get actors to do two films, you know, do Mean Guns and then do this other one. Mm-hmm. This other one is totally abstract and totally just an art film, but we do agree to do both. And all the actors said, well, we'll do both. You pay us the same. I said, I can't pay you the same because the other film is an abstract art film. It's not going to make a nickel. And so they said, no. So that film eventually went away because mm-hmm. it was hindering the ability to get Mean Guns rolling. And I really liked it a lot. And then one day I was eating in a restaurant and I heard Mambo on the restaurant system as I was working on the script. And it just clicked to me that the movie had to have Mambo.
You just gave me, I have three questions all lined up with all the things you just said. I want to ask the first, though, because this was a rumor I'd heard a long time ago, and I've never been able to confirm it. And you talked about the language of the script and how that appealed to you and the humor. I heard originally there wasn't going to be any profanity in the film, that was actually going to be a gag, that you have all these murderous psychopaths, and there was going to be absolutely no profanity in it, that they were going to say, oh, gosh darn, and shucks. And is that true?
Yeah, I think that is true, actually. But it was very fleeting.
what changed it? Because that would have been hysterical.
I think when we cast Ice-T,
okay.
I think Ice brings a certain level of profanity to anything he's involved in. Not on TV, but definitely
right.
in his film work. And it would, for him not to be able to do it in his style, seemed to be detrimental to, you know, his performance. So I think that's what really changed it.
Okay, so he was improvising a lot, and then it sort of threw away the whole joke then.
Yeah.
Because I remember there's one line in the film where a character even mentions that when you say a certain curse word over and over and over again, it loses all meaning. There's a little speech about profanity in the film.
Right. Yeah, so that, and I did, that's how that whole thing came, where I said, well, people, they should all watch their language because they're, you know, because after that speech and they're aware of how this guy feels about it, so people clean up their language.
Mm-hmm.
But I see, of course, just went right through that.
Wow. That's too bad. That was funny. I've seen it in something similar to that in Straight to Hell, the old Alex Cox movie. The next question I have is, because you were talking about the actors and carrying them over, this is one of the things that's always, again, fascinated me about your movies, is you get amazing actors. Do you rally for these people, or do they just sort of seem to seek you out? Like Michael Halsey, and of course Christopher Lambert, and all these wonderful, my gosh, Lance Henriksen and Tim Thomerson, the list is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I think I've been lucky that way. You know, I've been able to work with people that are pretty serious about their craft and approach their work in a really professional way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just really the luck of the draw where I was given an opportunity to be exposed to them in the casting process and wanting them to be in the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that I missed out on getting though. That's another story.
Yeah, that probably could be a show unto itself. All right, well then, to move in, you brought up the Mambo, so this will be a nice segue, because I don't know anybody who hasn't seen Mean Guns that doesn't remember the Mambo thing, but I'm a huge soundtrack aficionado. This very day, I just ordered is it pronounced Ripperetti, by the way, or Rip-A-Ready?
Rip-A-Ready.
I just ordered Cyborg. It was just released today by Howling Wolf Records.
Right.
And I just ordered it today, and I have always adored the music in your films. How important is the music in your films to you?
Well, I think that it's very important. I think it's one of the, you know, it's a big part of the movies that I do, is I hear the music for the film before I start it. I mean, it drives composers like Tony crazy, because then I get locked into a certain sound in a certain way, and it has to be. And for a lot of my films, I used to cut all my own temp music tracks myself. So I had a vast soundtrack collection, and you know, it's very important. It's one of the most important things for me.
Well, your films
are
also
one of the things I enjoy most about movies.
Mm-hmm.
Soundtrack.
Your films are so immersive to begin with. You seem to love to create other worlds for your characters to inhabit, and music just seems so inseparable from that. It seems so important.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that with all the films that I do, I think I hear the music for the film first before anything else. It's almost like the actors and everything else has to fit sort of the score. And the second thing that comes to me is usually the images.
Okay. So you sort of dream it to the music and then work it backwards retroactively. How did you become involved? Because Mr. Ripperetti's done a lot of your films. How did you become involved with him? What was it about his music that drew you to him?
I think in Radioactive Dreams, he submitted some songs that I really liked. And in those songs, I saw, you know, there's certain songs in songwriting where you can notice that it's filmic. And I just saw in Tony's work that there was a sensibility of telling a story and it was very filmic in their style. That's what drew me to him. And then, you know, I liked him personally and I liked his point of view of music. And, you know, it's more than just the what he created, but it's also just his own sensibility and how we collaborate. I really enjoyed that process. I tend to work with people I work with over and over again because I enjoy the collaboration as much as anything else.
Yeah, it's always nice from the viewer side of things. I also like that as well. I like seeing certain people you've worked with. I remember like Michael Halsey on Dollman, and seeing him back again in Mean Guns was really nice. And that's as a viewer and as someone who's talked to other fans of yours, we all tend to appreciate that. We love seeing those people come back over and over again, you know.
Yeah, and the one thing that when you work with somebody over and over again, when you've already have a working relationship, so you can kind of cut through, I guess, not so much their nicety, but you can cut through the conventional stuff and get right to some of the more interesting aspects. It allows me to push people. I mean, even like, you know, like I enjoyed working with Rutger twice and Christopher twice. I like to work because I feel that each time I can, now knowing them, I can help them achieve something more interesting. The same with Tony or any of the people that I work with all the time. I just feel that once you have that relationship, you can develop and help them also, you know, achieve their maximum creativity.
Now that is much more like it. And I'll be posting a link to that full episode of the Erase Rewind podcast so folks can hear the rest of Fred's fantastic interview with Mr. Pune, which is really kind of more of a career retrospective. You don't just hit on just one film or another. You really kind of start at the beginning and go for it.
Well, if I can be a little honest here, when I first decided to contact Mr. Pune about doing an interview, they wrote me back saying two things. One, it would only be a 10 to 15 minute interview. And number two, I had to submit all my questions in advance. I'm a bit more improvisational. That tends to be the way I work. I like to listen and then respond, and I create my questions as I go. It's just sort of the nature of the way I like to do it. So when I was asked to submit questions, I wasn't prepared. So what I did is I went around and I knew what I wanted to ask. You know, I did know the direction I wanted to go, but I wasn't sure how this would all work in a 10, 15 minute format. So I decided, what are people asking him that's just been asked a million times? I went around, read every interview I could find, listened to a lot. They were all about 5 to 15 minutes at the longest. And it was the same questions over and over and over again. And I was kind of happy because that wasn't the direction I wanted to go. I really am intrigued. And one of the things I wanted to cover on ER in the first place was how people really, you know, if you believe in this, if you really want to do this for a career, you work hard at it. And that's what I wanted to cover in Pune's interview. I wanted to talk about where did you start? How did you go through? What were you doing? You know, and it just flowed from there. I submitted the questions and they were very happy with them. They were very happy with them. And I literally got to ask almost every question I had on the sheet. What was supposed to be a 15-minute interview became about an hour and 15.
You know, I did that interview with Mondo Justin at the time. So he got 5 questions. I got 5 questions. Luckily, towards the end, it kind of broke down and became more of a discussion, so folks can hear that, how we start talking cameras and lenses and these kind of things. But you taking him from film school and doing the whole Mifune internship, you know, I never knew that there was a Toshiro Mifune, Albert Pune connection before, so that was awesome.
Neither did I until I did some research. It was really... There were a couple of things that came out in the interview that I must confess took me very aback. One of which I had was a nice little behind the scenes tidbit. Somebody had told me this. So I went into this with a little inside information, somebody that had worked on the set of Mean Guns. So I had that, you know, 6 degrees of separation thing going on. But the original script had no swearing in it. And this sort of took me aback. I was like, really? You know, because it's a rated R movie. There's no doubt. It's an R-rated movie. But there is one speech in the film that's delivered by a henchman about how if you swear constantly, it loses all meaning.
What's this damn thing all about, fellas?
They don't do that. I hate that.
Do what?
Swear when you don't have to.
What the hell are you talking about, boy?
I'll say hell whatever the hell I want to say, asshole.
Shut up. I'm just trying to make a damn cultural point, right?
Enough.
What are you, my God Almighty Father, all of a sudden?
Are we there yet? Okay, my space, your space.
What am I? It's
strange, isn't it? Us here and now.
Uh-huh. Why are we all together? Yes. We?
Together because we were told to be.
Yeah. Moon says you'll be picked up by a damn limo at the corner of 5th and Broadway.
So why don't you crawl up his ass for saying that, Ricky?
For saying what?
Damn limo.
Jesus, are we back on this?
Direct quote doesn't come.
Is damn even a swear word?
Who cares, for Christ's sake?
Hey, lady, I got a healthy respect for profanity, okay? It's just that they're not happy words, and it don't make me happy to hear them. Use something over and over and over again, you know, it ceases to have any meaning. Hell, 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 you know what I mean?
So what do you care if I use it, if it doesn't mean anything?
Look, all I'm saying is maybe you use them a little less, they mean a little more. Especially in the movies.
Well, that's why I use them, Ricky. Because they don't mean a damn thing.
I'm curious what it would have played out like had they kept that thing going. You know, would it have just been so weird at the time seeing Ice-T not swear if it would have just been almost, you know, stilted at that point? You know, I can see both sides of the coin. I like the idea of them not having the swearing, and I do like that speech and everything, but I don't mind that they kind of break that rule almost as soon as they set it up.
Well, in this particular case, I would have liked to have seen what it would have produced, because when you have the concept of profanity, a lot of times it's just used off the cuff. It's just, you know, F you, F this, and so on and so forth. This film does not actually do that very often, though. Again, it's a very strong script, and that's probably why. But if you have two characters that can't swear, they have to say something. And so it always propels the story forward, or you generally are forced to write something a little wittier. Again, I don't want to keep going back, but the only film I have to reference is Alex Cox's Straight to Hell. There are some weird speeches in that movie. And I think that comes from the fact that Alex set that rule. When you're forced to not fall back on a trope or a meme or anything that's more common, you're saying you have to say something original, and it has to pertain to the script. And I think that's what this script was going for, was that's why these characters are so rich. I don't know. It's one of those things. I think it could go either way. We've seen this way, and it still works. It's a great film. I still love it.
The other thing that really gets me, you know, listening to your interview, listening to the director's commentary, and then forever ago, we had talked to Deborah Van Valkenburg, and hearing about the efforts that they had to go through, since they only had Lambert for just a few days on this film, and they only had Ice-T for a few days on there too. But I mean, Lambert's throughout the entire movie, I can kind of see, you know, Ice-T is a little bit sequestered in his room. So, you know, I can kind of see that Wrath of Khan thing where, you know, you can shoot the two actors at different times, but yet have them interacting, those kind of things. But Lambert is throughout this entire film, and her talking about, oh yeah, well, we would shoot the scene, just shoot Chris, and then have to react to where he was and, you know, where the camera was moving. And it was just this whole like ballet of an actor being missing just because of the schedule and everything. And it was just like, oh my God, just that he was able to make this fantastic movie under all of these restrictions. You know, it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm amazed that it came together at all with here's one character, you get him for, you know, 3.5-4 days or whatever it was. And here's another character, you get him for one day. Good luck.
That's what he says on the commentary, that they were supposed to have Lambert for 5 days and they got him for 3.5. And Ice-T they got for 1 day. And you're right. It's amazing how Pune, he talks about this on the commentary, that he actually likes to set restrictions at the very beginning of every shoot. And they had lighting restrictions too. They could only use portable lights that you could plug into standard outlets. And if you've ever worked on a movie, people, you realize that's not what they use. You know, they have to have a balance box because the lights are so big, you know, and they'd blow out any house easily. He lit the entire thing with these very standardized lights. They couldn't get any blood on the floor because this was a real prison. And ironically, in the story, the prison is supposed to open the next day. So the events of the story take place the day before this maximum prison opens up. That's exactly what was happening in real life. They were shooting right up until the day before the prison was to open. And they couldn't get any blood on the floor. They couldn't do any major pyrotechnics in the film. So when you watch it, you'll be shocked that there's next to no blood. I mean, there's literally next to no blood. There's only like a little.
No blood and no swearing, but yet everyone having to kill one another.
Again, that's what I think is so intriguing about the movie, is for a film that's so brutal, it's entertainment value is not from the violence. This film really keeps you on who's going to make it throughout the whole film. It really is a battle royale in many ways. It's very similar to sort of a hybrid of, I still say, like The Most Dangerous Game, the story of The Most Dangerous Game is the most used story ever. It's the most remade concept ever. And it's a little bit of that into battle royale, into Mean Guns. It, you know, it has that similar who's going to make it. You get to know them and you feel for them. And Lou, for being such a psychopath, you're very drawn to him.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Tournament with Robert Carlyle. And gosh, who else is in that? Ving Rhames, I think. But it's interesting to kind of compare these two films because it's one of these, every year these assassins get together and they have this big tournament and, you know, who can kill everybody. And it seems like a really kind of backwards idea when you really think about it, because it's like, well, gosh, if these guys are professional assassins, I'm sure there's not that many of them out there. So if they're killing each other off, you know, that's really creating a huge demand in the whole law of supply and demand. But I guess they're just kind of, you know, raising their prices that way. But anyway, it's kind of like that, but it's out in the real world. So I think, again, having that restriction of it all being kept in the prison kind of makes it more interesting. You know, it's killer versus killer. There are some civilians, but it's not nearly as open to the field, as it were, in something like The Tournament, where it's literally on the streets of, you know, major cities kind of thing. I like that it's inside of this prison, and it's kind of like the most dangerous game of paintball or laser tag ever, since they're using real weapons.
Yeah, and I think, oddly enough, there is actually another movie that does, for the most part, actually rip off Mean Guns. It's actually set in a confined space where a bunch of agents, like CIA agents and FBI, and that they're all brought together because they know too much, and they find out they're all supposed to kill each other off. Unfortunately, I cannot remember the name of it to save my life, but that was the basic premise. It was the same. The first time I saw the trailer, I went, oh, that's Mean Guns.
You know, and going back to the lighting stuff that you were talking about, I love the lighting scheme in this whole thing, and I love the way that they kind of pre-flash the film and everything. And it's great listening to the director's commentary just to hear how into the technical stuff Pune is, going through the processing and, you know, what kind of film works better. And he did the same thing when he was talking to you, I think, talking about this film stock versus this other film stock and all this kind of stuff. You know, and it's just like, this guy is really into his craft, and it just really shows, you know. And I think Pune kind of gets a bum rap sometimes just because some of the movies he's directed maybe haven't done as well as they might have. But then again, going back to your interview, the whole sad story of like, well, I was working on this film and then that got taken away from me, or I didn't have this, you know, I never had director's cut on this. And just, it's like, my God, you know, any other person might have given up after the fifth or sixth time that happened, but he kept it going, man.
His sensibilities, I picked up on that pretty much early on, even before the interview. I noticed that his films look a lot like Hong Kong cinema. He seems to share that sensibility. I know I asked him something about that, and he has confirmed that that's exactly – he thinks of himself more in the European style and the Asian markets. And I think the problem is that they don't know what to do with his work. Is a good example. Just, you know, anybody that's worked on a short film or anything could probably see where this happens. I was shooting a little comedy with some friends once, and my friend was like, I don't know why I'm doing this. And I told him, just trust me. Okay, you know, it'll make sense when I edit it together. We filmed it, and I showed him a rough cut just so he knew, you know, later on what I was doing. He goes, oh, now I get it. And I think that's what happens with Pune, is that he films this material, and the producers, they only see the dailies. And a daily, for those that don't know, maybe on this show, everybody who listens to you knows it, but they take the film stock that was shot that day and they produce a daily so they can see, were there any mistakes? Was the lighting good? You know, this is not the final print. And I think the producers just see his dailies and go, what is this guy doing? And they don't see it, and they don't wait. They don't allow him to even compile it all, because it seems like his story is the same. He gets to edit his cut, and then they literally that day show him the door, and they don't even look. They don't even look. They've already decided. That's what happened with Cyborg, and Jean-Claude Van Damme took over that one, of all people. And it's a shame, because it's sad that in some ways we'll never really get to know what – and maybe Mean Guns is the closest, because Mean Guns, he's claimed, is the film that no one bothered him on. It's sad to say, for his other films, we'll never really get to know what his full visions were, because as you get older, your vision changes. So when you re-edit, it's not like that's what I was going for. You're still a different person, you know, 10 years, 15 years after. So you're not going to make the same choices you would have when you were 10 years, 15 years younger. And so that's the sad thing. We may never know what Pune's vision for instance, Sword and the Sorcerer, which is one of my all-time favorites of his. And I found out that one was taken away from him. So his very first movie was taken away from him. And he spent 5 years developing that film. And 3 years in active development. That's why he gets a bad rap. We've never really gotten to see, up until Mean Guns, what an Albert Pune film would look like.
We should talk about this whole concept, this whole thing that he's doing now, these renegade director's cuts, where he's selling these films via his website, just pune.com, P-Y-U-N.com. And now I have heard you talk about Cyborg and just that it's, you know, night and day comparing the two versions of Cyborg.
It is. So far, pretty much all of his edits. And so people know, if you do pick up Mean Guns, make sure, A, you do buy it from Albert Pune and go through his Facebook page. Going through his website page is not very active anymore. I think one of them's even gone. So go through his Facebook and you can just Albert Pune and it pops up on Facebook. No problem. And buy it directly through them. And he calls that his director's cut. And the funny thing is there's nothing changed. he didn't recut it at all. It's just in widescreen.
It's kind of funny. I feel like almost I should call him out a little bit just because he is calling these things director's cuts and they're not necessarily like Cyborg definitely is.
When I did the interview or before it and I sent the questions, I referred to Cyborg as the director's cut. And I got a paragraph back to me saying, do not call this a director's cut. You know, whatever you do, it's a renegade cut. You know, and then here comes Mean Guns, which is called a director's cut. It's not. It's just widescreen. It's the director's vision, no doubt, because it's meant to be seen wide. But yeah, it's not a director's cut. But Cyborg most certainly is.
Yeah, it's funny that he is calling that the director's cut, but and the one thing that makes me really sad, and I was completely remiss in not sending you the full interview that we did with Pune forever ago, because he talks a lot about Captain America and that he found his version of Captain America before it was taken away from him and, you know, how different it was. And he was just really explaining, you know, all these differences between his version and the one that we saw and all this kind of stuff. And then the DVD comes out via his website. And the only thing that's different is that part of the middle of the movie was moved to the beginning of the movie as kind of a flash forward, almost kind of what they did in Mean Guns, where you see Ice-T at the beginning and then, you know, you see that same scene later on in the film. But it's like, okay, so are we ever going to see that version? Because I would really like to see what you were describing. Sounds great.
There are actually extra scenes, though, in the Captain America. There's two
really?
Extra scenes. Oh, yeah. There's one scene that was completely cut out where Captain, he gets a job. I think he's like the guy that cleans up at like a Gold's Gym or something to make it kind of funnier. You know, like here's this guy that could lift any of those things and he just cleans up there. And then he goes to visit Michael Norrie's character as an old man in a retirement home. Those scenes were excised.
I don't remember that at all.
Forgive me. I can't remember everything. And that's for people listening. Please understand that there are about 800 versions of every Pune movie. So this gets seriously because there's like there's the American adrenaline. Then there's the European adrenaline. And now he wants to do a cut of adrenaline. So some of this stuff can get very confusing. And with Captain America, they released a Blu-ray and a DVD. And they're not the same cut.
Oh, okay.
And so it depends on which one you buy. And he promised this one scene before this was off. And by the way, I'm not putting him down. Just so you understand, they're doing this stuff off the cuff. This is not put down. This is just this man is dealing with a lot. And he's trying to do this while making new movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he has a very active career. I mean, he's, you know, Road to Hell has yet to come out. That one he's been working on for forever. You know, Tales of the Ancient Empire just came out. He had been working on that one for a long time. And I don't
know. He's working on Slinger.
Yeah, he's
right
got
now.
All these things still in the hopper. So he's doing all the new stuff and revisiting all of his old stuff. So, yeah, we're not capping on him at all.
Yeah, this is just, you know, the facts of the way they're going. And I'll tell you what, if you followed his Facebook page, he's extremely honest. Like, he'll tell you everything. But they promised there is a scene that was never released where we see Red Skull composing a song. And I believe it's the melody he's playing at the very end of the movie. And you see where he's composing and he's remembering his childhood. And this scene is more integral to what's left of his humanity. The problem with Captain America, though, unlike some of his other films, is the other films were completed. Captain America was not completed. Actually, they had no money to bring the crew back from Italy. The money literally ran out as they were filming. They did not know how they were going to get actor Ronnie Cox and Matt Salinger back. There was no money. This movie was never completed. I think he said it was right during the scene where you see a helicopter land and these motorcycles come barreling out after Captain America. It was literally that's when the money was cut down to next to nothing. They said, oh, this is all you've got now to complete the movie. And so they weren't even a quarter of the way into filming the movie when the budget was, you know, they lost something like 75% of the budget, and they literally ran out before they could even finish filming it. So that one's really, again, that's why it's so hard to judge some of his movies, because so many different factors play into it. And it's one of those things when people ask me, what should I start with? You know, I always start with the best ones, you know, Sword and the Sorcerer, Mean Guns. And then you go from there based on the person's taste. You know, Doll Man might be a fun one for them to see. That's something I learned on the interview I did with him, too. He wasn't paid for Doll Man. He was like, how do you not get paid for all that work? You know,
I guess he worked for Charles Band.
I guess so, because I know for a fact, like with, oh, I better not say it, but a particular actor that's been in many Full Moon movies, he's paid up front. You know, you wonder how that kind of happens. It's very strange because if you look at Doll Man, it does not look like any other Full Moon movie out there. And that's a good thing. He brings such a unique sensibility to every film he works on. If he does a post-apocalyptic film, Radioactive Dreams, it doesn't look like any other post-apocalyptic movie. He was one of the first to jump on the cyberpunk scene with Nemesis, which was another movie actually that didn't get fully completed, not to his liking. But again, the editing was taken away from him on that one. But you'll never see another movie that looks like it. But enough movies have ripped it off since. Yeah, he was the first to do a lot of this material. And back then, they didn't know what to do with it. You know, the only guys doing that kind of thing was John Woo, Sui Hark. But that was over in China. You know, those films weren't quite, you know, they were hitting the bootleg convention circuit in America, but they weren't mainstream at all. You know, now you can, you know, buy Jackie Chan, Sui Hark, John Woo, you know, Amazon.com. But back then, these films were not easy to get. They were not easy to see. And Pune's sensibilities were closer to those than the American ones.
Yeah, and I love his sense of humor, too. I mean, just, you know, I mean, his outright comedies of Brain Smasher, Love Story. And there's so much humor in Omega Doom, you know, just, which is terrific. You know, watching that movie, it took me like a few minutes before I realized, I was like, oh, this is Yojimbo. You know, this is another take on that, which was kind of nice. Him kind of going back to his Mifune roots and, you know, kind of doing a nod to Kurosawa with that, which was terrific. I mean, that character in there who literally keeps losing his head, just was terrific. So, and you know, he knows how to work with actors too. He always gets great performances out of people.
Yeah, that's the key. He has a great stable. There's no doubt about it that there's people that keep popping up. Michael Halsey, Tina Cotey, Tom Matthews has been in a ton, and people might know Tom from Return of the Living Dead. You know, as the whiny punk. But I need brains. There's an actor, oddly enough, it's funny that some of these people's careers really kind of mirror Pune a little bit. You know, they're so talented. Michael Halsey, I don't know why somebody like him's not in more movies. And Tom Matthews, I thought he would go on to big things. This guy, I've seen him in a lot of movies, and they were all very different from each other. And his performance is always different. Like, they just released Zone Troopers finally to DVD. I love Zone Troopers. It's in its proper aspect ratio, too. You got to get it through Amazon, and it's those, you know, they do that thing now where they just burn directly to a DVD minus R. I hate that, but I'll tell you what, I'm glad to have Zone Troopers, and Tom Matthews is wonderful in that. But my point is that he's got this great stable of actors that for some reason are underutilized. You just, you know, why aren't we seeing people like Tim Thomerson and Rutger Hauer? And, you know, these guys should be A-listers. And Albert still gets A-list performances from them in B, sometimes Z-grade films. And not everybody could do that. Just go look at some of those other DVDs next to Pune's films, and you can find that out quickly.
Exactly. All right, so we're going to take a break, and we'll play a clip from next week's movie.
You think I'm a whore. You think I like to let strange men touch me? That I spread my legs in dark motels and watch in the mirror while they grab my piece and stick another quarter in the TV? You think I'm cheap, but I don't do it for money. I do it because I want to. You think I do it for you. That's why you stare at me. But you like to watch me, to see me do dirty things. But I'm not gonna show you. That's private. I'm gonna cover up. I'm gonna hide myself. I'm gonna disappear. My whole body could just be snuggled inside a gorgeous piece. It would be so dark they couldn't see me.
So be sure to tune in next week when we talk about the avant-garde adult film Night Dreams with Chris Gore, Josh Hadley, and possibly Samurai from The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. So I want to thank this week's co-host, Fred Fritz, once again for stopping by the projection booth. Fred, I need you to tell the folks at home about Movie Apocalypse, which for me is one of the most ambitious and well-made movie shows out there on the interwebs.
Wow, thank you. Well, Movie Apocalypse basically came to be because, you know, a lot of people today tear movies down, you know, a lot of reviewers. And that's fine. That's their own thing. They're doing comedy. You know, they're not really doing reviews. They're doing comedy skits. So I'm fine with that. But I noticed not as many people were giving a lot of love to movies. And people complain a lot about today's films. And sometimes I just couldn't help but feel that when I heard these other people talk, they weren't referencing the past. Specifically, here's a great example because of my last episode of Movie Apocalypse was about Bob Clark's Murder by Decree. Bob Clark is, in my opinion, one of the most diverse, amazing directors who came up through the 70s and the 80s. Nobody was as diverse as this man in the style of films. He did, well, start with the most obvious, A Christmas Story, considered a huge classic now. Then he did films like Porky's. He did Black Christmas, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, From the Hip, Turk 182. Seriously, this guy's career is so diverse. And then Murder by Decree was a Sherlock Holmes film, Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper. And I remember seeing people doing reviews of Super Babies or Baby Geniuses. It was Baby Geniuses, Super Babies. And this was a Bob Clark film in the last years of his life. And they're terrible. They're, you know, but they're for children. They're meant for toddlers. And they were not mentioning this wonderful, you know, career of this man. They might just say he once did Christmas Story, but now he makes junk. And that bothered me. And so I said, I'm going to make a show that highlights these films. You know, it doesn't tear them down. It says, you should really go check these films out, and here's why. And, of course, the rest of it is just me, you know, playing around and having fun. I'm a post-apocalyptic wanderer that is digging up these movies and trying to preserve them for future generations. So that's just me having fun and playing director.
Right, but it looks really good, and I like that it is all video. You know, I won't say it's easy to do what I'm doing right now, sitting in front of a microphone and just recording these and everything. You know, there is a little, just modicum, you know, like 2 seconds worth of work for this kind of stuff. But you're out there, you're shooting this stuff, you're lighting this stuff. I mean, I notice your lighting is fantastic and you're doing all this stuff and you're these great production values on what could just be another movie show. So I appreciate that you're taking that and going one step beyond everybody else. And then, like you said, you are building these movies up and showing why people should be enjoying these movies. So far, you know, you've done the two episodes you did. Murder by Decree was number two. Mm-hmm. Number one, Road Games, which again, I think we mentioned on the Hitcher episode a few weeks ago. And that is one of a lot of people's favorite road terror movies out there. A terrific performance by Stacey Keach, you know, great Jamie Lee Curtis in there. And so, and you're just, you know, the way that you take people through the movie without spoiling it, giving us some highlights, you know, really showing us why people should be enjoying these, you know, hats off to you on that. But I have to ask you, what's coming up on the Movie Apocalypse?
Oh, I like to keep it secret if I can. It's only because this has become one of those things where everybody, well, if anybody knows anything about reviewers today, they're a dime a dozen. I'm one of them. Okay. I'm saying I'm a dime a dozen guy. It's just that there's a lot of competition. As an example, when I released Murder by Decree, someone else released a review of the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes. And it was just one of those things. I released my video one day, they released theirs the second day. And of course, you know, it takes time to shoot and edit. So neither one was planned with the other. It's just, that's what happens. And I try to keep a secret. I'll give a little away. It's going to be, I'm going to keep people guessing on this show. So I'm going to try to cover different things and why you should check them out. And again, that's part of the show. But the next one, we're going a little further back. We're actually going to hit a couple black and white. It's going to be a double feature. That was one thing I didn't give away. It's going to be a double feature this time. It's going to be a black and they're going to be black and white films that star two of the same people that worked together several times. And these films both have influenced modern movies. In fact, one of them is dang near a direct copy of the film I'll be reviewing.
Okay, great. So be sure to head on over to movieapocalypse.com or look for it via Facebook for updates on it and Fred's other projects. Even at just two episodes, like I said, this is one of my favorite things on the web currently. So, and hey, you know, to get the director's cut, renegade cut, whatever you want to call it, of Mean Guns or more, head on over to pune.com. Or again, per Fred's point earlier, look for Albert over on Facebook. I think it's what, Albert Pune Movies. And then he's also on Twitter and stuff. So definitely one of the more plugged in directors that's out there these days. And be sure to stop on by www.projection-booth.com for more of the Projection Booth. Like I said earlier, we'll be posting up the interview that Mondo Justin and I did with Albert Pune on April 2nd, 2011. And I'll also be posting links to the Erase Rewind interview that Fred did with Albert Pune, which is much better, but you should still listen to the one that we did too, because he talks a lot about Road to Hell and more about Captain America and all kinds of other good stuff. So check that out on projection-booth.com. And if you want to listen to other episodes of Projection Booth, get them over at iTunes, Stitcher, listen to them on Jackalope, you know, the usual kind of stuff. So, all right, thanks again, Fred, for stopping by. It was really good talking to you.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure being here.
All right, cool biz. We'll talk to you soon.